fear is here. It's not paying the dues. I'd gladly pay the equivalent of the dues not to have this thing. So the dues are a problem. They're a problem in general. But the point I'm getting at is there are even more fundamental things for people that are professionally interested in, say, their own profession, their own field of science, or whatever they're working in. They're committed to that as a professor, not as a teacher that's doing just teaching like a high school or community college teacher. They're interested in the whole ball game. They're concerned about this, and they're concerned about how you represent something as diversity as this, with a union that's only made up by the members, and a lot of people won't be members in the first place.
Is this a question?
That's a question. I want to show up response.
Well, I don't know. I think in my opening statement, I said that one of my basic problems with the AFUA's approach to life in Fairbanks is the failure to come to grips with priorities, because that's what you're talking about, how you make value choices that reconcile competing needs for money and various other resources that the university has in insufficient amounts to satisfy everyone. The bargaining council that the union has set up is a small part of that. It's stacked against Fairbanks, and it's totally advisory, but it's part of the procedure. If it had been set up 6 months or a year ago, it might tell us at least which direction the union is heading. The group within the union that will make those decisions is the bargaining team. I don't know if that particular component of the union apparatus has been selected yet, but it either has been or will be selected by the union president. It'll be approved by, I believe, the union's executive board and the bargaining council, and then it's on its own. Can't be removed, doesn't get voted on again, can hire anyone it wishes, can spend as much money as it wants. It negotiates the contract. It stays in office until a contract is negotiated. So that's the group that will make the decisions, and I don't know how they'll do it.
Question?
Yeah,
back there.
Merit.
No, behind.
We've got faculty, students, administration sitting up front, and I suppose, Merit, by your being staff, there's a staff member up there. There's one element of the university is not sitting up there, and I noticed one representative who visited the audience. I'm wondering if you'd entertain the possibility of a question of a member of the Board of Regents, if he would be willing to respond. John?
I think I'd rather not do that, since we're limiting the questions from the audience to the panel. And perhaps the question can be addressed at a later time. Do you have a question for the panel itself?
Well, since the chancellor's there, perhaps he can speak to the board. Has the board taken a stand on unionization?
Well, the board has agreed to abide by, there's no agreement, and it's the law that says if the faculty wishes to organize and bargain collectively with the board, it will bargain collectively with the board. You mean a stand for
favoring
I don't know that I can. Let me clarify. I am constrained by law somewhat in terms of what I can say and what I cannot. So I'm trying to think of whether or not I'm threatening, cajoling, or promising, which I can't do. Yeah. Well, I think it would be appropriate to state that what you hear from me as representative of the administration as it pertains to the views on collective bargaining, that represents pretty much the board point of view, that they don't feel that collective bargaining enhances the excellence of the University of Alaska system.
Okay, any other questions? Let me see. good as somebody else.
Yeah, the third, fourth row from the back.
Yeah. I had a question, actually a comment that everyone else seems to have loved, a statement by Dr. Collins passed by. He said the faculty was the most important. I don't know if I'm giving a direct quote, but you certainly heard that the faculty was the most important part of the university. I guess I was always under the mistaken impression that it was the students, but.
I'd like to appreciate that.
No, I was, I intended to refer to people who work for the university, you see. The administrators work for the university, too, you know. No, the students are, that's what it's all about.
Any other questions?
No. In fact, I want to convey this. I suggested it earlier, and this, of course, is my impression. Once again, I'm not necessarily talking everybody's impression, but my impression is that the faculty members are more productive, and I gave some facts earlier with regard to this. And one of the main reasons for it, I think, is that they can now act, go about what they're supposed to be doing, teaching, research, and public service, knowing that collectively they have certain protections against arbitrary unilateral decisions. Let me give you an example. On the 1st of December or thereabouts, 1979, just 3 months after the University of Maine faculty and Board of Trustees, we call it, ratified the first contract, the acting vice president of academic affairs at the University of Maine at Orono, not knowing that there was a new collegiality now and you don't just do what you please, sent out a letter to all faculty members, a memo to all faculty members, directing them or informing them that they will be in their offices during what he called the student vacation. One of the deans picked this up, I suppose, hoping someday himself to be a vice president. Scheduled meetings for his whole faculty throughout the what was called the student vacation. It was humorous. It looked like a Girl Scout camp program. It had, for example, 9 to 10, faculty would hear such and such a person speak. 10 to 11, the faculty would discuss what was said. 11 to 1, lunchtime. 1 to 2, another discussion. 2 to 3, free time. It was actually on there. Well, we didn't let that stand. Very quickly, the association invoked certain provisions of the contract, including a meet and discuss provision, article on meet and discuss. We met with the president, discussed formally the problem and how this particular action violated past practice. It was an unreasonable change in working conditions and so on, and that was retracted, this particular vice president's action. I may have gotten too far away from your question, but I...
Yeah, on the aisle there. Could you please choose somebody else on the panel so we don't have a...
In addition to Professor Shaw, who else do you want to hear from?
Why don't we ask Ann?
I'll volunteer.
Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, it's possible to, the process is, the legal term is decertification, because what we're really voting on is, although we use the phrase having a union, the university already has a union, but it just doesn't have any power right now. What we're talking about is certifying this union to be our collective bargaining agent, and then the process that we would refer to as getting rid of the union is decertification. And the union could, in that case, continue along in much the way that certain other groups in the campus do today. But it's not easy. It's considerably more difficult than the procedure we're going through right now, which is no bed of roses either. Decertification under Alaska law can only occur during a 30-day window. I think it's 180 to 150 days before the end of a contract period. And during that window, there has to be a collection of signature cards taken to the State Labor Relations Agency, and then the whole thing is put to a vote. So it can happen, but the problem is that once the union gets in, it has a, like any social institution, it has a desire to perpetuate itself. It's not anything that's peculiar to unions, but it, I'm sure, exists. And the fact that the union and the administration have squared off over this negotiating business for years and years makes it that much more difficult for the faculty to come back and work with the administration on a gentleman-to-gentleman, gentle-person-to-gentle-person basis. You get the point. That's my answer.
Ed or Roger?
I'll just amplify on what Dave said. It is possible, as he stated. The procedure is very well defined. The reason that it hasn't happened more often than it has is not so much, however, because of the procedural matters involved, but because it's an extremely rare case when the faculty wants it, because they like what they have once they get it. With regard to the second part of Dave's response to this, with regard to the question of gentlemanly interaction with the administration, we've already had a statement from the chancellor saying that, as far as he's concerned, the question of adversary relationship need exist only over the collective bargaining table. He said he will stand by that. We say the same thing. As far as we're concerned, that's also the only place there need to be any kind of adversarial relationship.
Merritt, I'm being misquoted. I feel the need to clarify. But defer to your judgment.
What was the other question? And who are you addressing that to?
I don't have any personal knowledge that it has happened. I do have knowledge that in the large majority of the cases it hasn't happened. I can't speak to the specific instances in any case where it has.
Relative to my quote?
Yes.
Thank you, Wolf. I was hoping somebody would ask. It's not so much as a misquote as it didn't go far enough. I agree with the words that Roger attributed to me, but both at the time I interviewed and again, what, a week ago, I did add the rest of it, and that is it ought to stay at the bargaining table. Unfortunately, that has not been my experience as I perceived it with the collective bargaining unit. The adversarial relationships have persisted.
Let's get somebody. Bill?
One of the reasons that some of these
bugaboo type questions have arisen is that the President of the University put out a letter to earlier last year saying a number of things. And one of the things he said was that yes, indeed, folks, you vote in the union, you're going to start from zero, which was a bit of a threat. The other thing that he said was here's this union, folks, asking you to assign your bargaining rights to it. And I looked at that and I said, gee, and all that's what happens, but what rights do I have with bargaining? And so I'd like to ask the Chancellor, I get a letter once a year, which I used to get a professional contract, now I get a letter which says a bunch of things, and it says, if you agree to the above, sign here. And it usually comes at a time when, up until this last year, it came at a time far beyond the expiration of the previous letter. And in this letter, it says, I agree to abide by the rules of the university, as they are now, or as they might have changed in the following year. And I would have wondered, first of all, is that legal? Can I really legally sign myself away that way? And I, what I'd like to do is, I would like to come in and individually, apparently under collegiality I could do this, bargain with you on what rights, what changes you might possibly do or make in the coming years that would pertain to me, because I don't think I'd be doing that. The other thing I'd like to do is...
Are you saying you'd want to do that?
Yeah, if we don't have this. The other thing I want to do is I want to bargain with you about the rules that are in existence, because I've read the rules, and there are some rules in there that say, well, there's one nebulous rule that I run for political office, and it almost indicates if you run for precinct chairman, you have to get your supervisor's approval. Is this open to, I mean, do I have this kind of bargaining right with you, or not?
Well, yeah, Bill, of course you do. I mean, what do you think I am, huh? Now, let me respond a little. No. Through the mechanisms that are currently available is what I am saying. You know, how many of you participated in the recent hearings that the Assembly held on the compensation policy? How many went? Wow, that's a pretty small minority. You know, they've had notices out for quite a while about this item coming up. This package has been out and disseminated for quite a while, you know. That's the mechanism that you use, Bill. You know, wait a minute, come on now. No, we're talking about a system that represents, regardless of whether or not you join the union, Roger continues to talk about a democratic organization, but rest assured, ladies and gentlemen, it's a democratic organization that requires membership in order to have voting rights within that. Okay?
I belong to the university faculty assembly, more or less, whether I have some say whether I want it or not. So this is collectivism that's forced on me. Either I participate or I don't. And what you're saying, and the university...
No, Bill, you don't have to participate.
And you don't have to participate in the union? The thing is, what you want me to do is go and abide by what the assembly hopefully can ask you or the university to agree to.
Well, listen, you know...
Basically, largely the same, except that if you don't have to...
Is largely what?
By law. There's a lot of the sameness.
Sameness.
Yeah, but the difference is that the university administration must, by law, negotiate with the union.
As pertains to wages, working conditions, and other conditions affecting the employment. Yes, I agree that under a collective bargaining law, that is an absolute mandate. I also agree, and I've never tried to maintain otherwise, that under the existing law, that is not legally guaranteed, if that is the point. But let me tell you that, you know, what you gain in terms of legal status is legal status as a union. That's a lot different than legal status as a faculty. All of a sudden, you are a representative of a private interest group. Your motivations become suspect.
We have 5 minutes on this issue. Let's ask another question. In the center in the back.
You. Very brief comment. Mr. Collins gave an example of how the administration apparently had taken steps to indicate that they wanted a 40-hour work week or that they wanted staff to have more regular working hours and be there during the time the students were away. Presumably the staff were being paid at that time. and he indicated what the union's response to the administration was. That sounded like very much an adversarial relationship to me. It didn't sound collegial. As a matter of fact, I suggested the assistance on a 40-hour work weekend without taking account of the evenings and weekends and the various other things that normal professorial duties usually take care of does, in fact, do away with collegiality and does, in fact, put down professionalism and speak of blue-collar working conditions. I think his own example spoke of the truth in that statement.
Do you have a question now?
I'd like him to comment on
it. I'd be happy to. At the University of Maine, in the past and at the present, we have no such thing as a timesheet. We're professionals. I teach so many hours, and I'm expected to be somewhat of a scholar in my field. I try to do that. Nobody cares when I do it, where I do it, as long as I meet my classes. See, we're judged at the University of Maine not on when we're in our offices, but what we produce. That's the way it was before. The union didn't bring that into being. But the union's not going to let it leave either. What had happened here, you see, this student vacation, I don't know what you do here. Surely you don't have to, I mean, how are you judged here? Not for being in your office. I mean, this is insane. So what happened? Now, there was an adversarial way. I think this ought to be corrected. Even our own person perhaps was a little in error on this. There is an adversarial relationship at the bargaining table. I mean, by definition, we propose, you counterpropose, and so on. There's also an adversarial relationship when the administration acts unilaterally to the deprivation of the faculty in violation of the clear legal contract. Of course. What, do we just smile and say, oh, shucks, you know, we have to be in on Christmas Eve now? No. That's adversarial when there's a violation of the contract. I think it should be, and it always will be.
Other questions? Yeah.
Professor Collins spoke of one of the immediate benefits of unionization in Maine was the increase in faculty salaries. And I would assume that a similar circumstance would arise here if the union is voted in. I'm curious as to know who bore the brunt of the pay rise that went to the faculty members. And will that result in a cutback of any existing services here, or will it result in a tuition hike, or is the union confident that the legislature will go along and fund the university budget, that will increase pay raises?
Yes, well, I'll be brief because I don't know what would happen here. I couldn't very well predict. At the University of Maine, the state legislature in Maine, believe it or not, occasionally has a surplus, and people get it, you don't have to raise taxes to take in more money. People get pay increases, and therefore their taxes increase. I don't know how it works here, but we have state sales tax and income tax, so it taxes everything. What has happened was not tuition increases or tax increases. It's just that the University of Maine or the state legislature appropriated more money to fund the contracts of the University of Maine. I think, in all sincerity, I think the state legislature in Maine has come to believe that the asset of a quality institution is great, a quality university. No question but that it benefits the state. I would think, I understand you have a lot of oil money here. I don't know anything about that, though. I think they could probably come up with a little more money.
I guess he addressed the question to both of us. Again, I can't predict what will happen with regard to where the money comes from, but in all of these cases, and that's why we're looking at the example of Maine, the best example of what will happen is history. History gives us our best example for a predictor of what is going to happen. In this state, in the cases when pay increases have been given, they have been passed as a separate item in the legislature. So the legislature has separately allocated that money.
The Public Employment Relations Act requires that any provision negotiated in the contract which has a fiscal impact be submitted to the legislature for funding and is not implementable unless funded by the legislature.
Yeah.
There's one thing that still reflecting to me in terms of how we come up with the final item in terms of the negotiations here at UA, University of Washington. So I'm addressing this for Roger because I've read the thing in terms of statewide bargaining council, and I'll tell you what I think, and then you can tell me where I went wrong. Is that the bargaining council consists of three representatives of each camp, and apparently they just simply put together the grocery list. They don't make any determination in terms of, personally, in terms of priority. They put it together in some sort of priority, I would assume, in terms of a shopping list. They give this to the negotiating team, but the negotiating team can go to the grocery store and decide to buy what they want to. That's what it looks like to me. There is no built-in guarantee that number one is going to be number one and number two is going to be number two or whatever, because it says that they can operate independently and they're responsible for drafting the contract. So what you go in to ask for is what that bargaining team decides to ask for. Now, hopefully, they will listen to it. But I don't see any built-in guarantees that they will be responsible for the actions in doing and ensuring the idea of the one-man, one-vote principle.
Well, let me assure you that in the operation, we will follow the democratic process, number one. But let's go into the bargaining process again. We've tried to educate as much as possible through the literature we've sent out and through some of the answers that have been given in the Chancellor's reception, Chancellor's discussion a week ago and in other at other points. But there are three members from each campus on the statewide bargaining council. That statewide bargaining council, along with membership and along with continual interaction back and forth with the members, will determine priorities that are to be taken to the bargaining table, but not, as you stated, in terms of their personal view, but on the basis of the input they have from the faculty and the membership. And in any bargaining council that did not respect the wishes of the faculty, the wishes of the membership, would be just spinning their wheels. They'd be going forward with something that wasn't going to be approved by their membership. So the democracy has to be there in order to make the thing work. Then when it goes to the bargaining table, the decision as to what you want to push for, what priorities are, the bargaining team then argues these positions at the bargaining table. Now, you're not going to get everything you ask for, necessarily. And the determination of what you get and what you don't get are part of the bargaining process. But the protection for that is once that whole process is all the way finished, you come back again for a vote. Do you want this? Do you want what we bargained?
It's 2 o'clock, ladies and gentlemen. I'll take one more question.
Can I ask one other clarification in regards to that response?
Yeah, but it's real short.
Okay. Do you also ask the membership what they're willing to give up? In other words, you're going in with the grocery list to ask them something you want. Do you also ask them what they're willing to give up when they go in?
I can tell you one thing, that they would never agree to give anything up at all at the bargaining table without consulting with the membership.
Okay, one other question.
I have 2 questions for Roger, but one of them is very short, just because he has no answer. Has Ted Drain appointed the negotiating team yet?
No.
Okay, thank you. The other question, given that you keep talking about that we need the input from the faculty to decide what to bargain for, the faculty's been around for quite a while, and the union has been around formally for something over a year now. It has a set of offices in place, had lots of chance for both formal and informal contact with faculty. Has the union come up with a single specific demand that they intend to place on the negotiating table?
I think I've answered that question a couple or three times today. Essentially, we're again being asked to state what our priorities are ahead of time before we've even gotten the faculty input with regard to what they ought to be. In answer to what appears to be the first part of the process implied, that is, why hasn't this taken place earlier, the answer is that we are now going into the election. After the election, assuming that we are successful, then We hope to involve a lot more faculty, both in terms of input and in terms of membership, than we have now involved the process. I think there's a good argument to be made that the greatest possible involvement of the affected faculty will give us the kind of priority, set of priorities that would be best for the faculty.
Is it wrong for us to ask you to state your priorities before we decide whether or not to certify you?
I think if you asked me to state my priorities, it wouldn't have any meaning. It wouldn't have any effect, because my priorities are not what's...
More important.
Pardon?
Ted Drain's priorities might be more important.
I don't think the priorities of any one individual are the important thing, because no one of us can go in with our private agenda and say, this is what we're going to ask for, because it isn't an authoritarian organization. It's a democratic organization.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.